Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me is my always here co-host. I almost, slipped up earlier.
I'm always here, Chad.
He is always here, Chad, Mr. Chad.
Except for that one time.
Except for that one time.
I wasn't here.
When he
things
wasn't
fell
here.
Apart.
And we had a show that talked about everything he's not a fan of, so.
You missed me.
But you know what? We have an exciting show in store for you guys, and we're going to have a great topic to talk about. But we're not alone. We also have with us today head movie reviewer and editor for Nerd Reactor, Mr. Mark Passis. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How are you guys?
We're great. We're awesome.
Can't complain. We are awesome.
We are awesome. I mean, you got to say it out loud. You know, we're awesome.
At least for the next hour.
True. And then the drugs will wear off.
Wow.
But, Mark and I, we go way back. We actually write for the same website, and Mark is a brother from another Asian mother, and we have an awesome time talking all the time. So
you don't have an Asian mother?
I do. It's Mark's mom.
Oh.
Oh.
But then that's not another. That's the same.
But she's another mother.
You're confusing me today.
You know what? We're going to have a great show, and that's all that matters.
Awkward.
The Beast is coming, and no, not the Disney one. And The Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live at VGB Studios. The Filmlosophers podcast is suitable for every personality, and subscription is free on all of your favorite platforms. New episodes are available every week on Stitcher, Libsyn, Google Play, Audio Boom, Player FM, and iTunes. When the voices in your head just aren't good company anymore, chat us up on the socials. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101 to connect with other Filmlosophy fans. Finally, tune into all of the podcasts in the VGB Studios family by visiting our website at vgbstudios.com. There you'll find the entire episode library for the Filmlosophers, Video Game Bang, and me, Mike, Self, and I. And also, we gotta let you know, you still got time to cast your vote for monkeysfightingrobots.com. Head over to the site, look for The Filmlosophers, and cast your vote.
Yeah, the is very important. Usually we throw it away and think it's not an important article, but it is.
And I would have...
Without it, you won't find us.
True. I would have assumed if I submitted the podcast as The Filmlosophers, you would have thought they would have kind of pushed the to the side and just said, oh, Filmlosophers, okay.
But nope.
But as I said, we have a great show in store. And if you haven't gotten a little bit of a clue in the beginning introductions, we'll kind of get into it a little bit later. But first, before anything
else...
Or
the title of the episode. But, that's neither here nor there. Episode.
That's true. But we always hit the movie news. And the biggest movie news of them all. The Oscar nominations are finally here.
Woohoo!
So, as Oscar season enters its final
congratulations,
stretch...
Congratulations, Amy Adams and Tom Hanks. Oh, wait.
Aww.
Wait.
Wah, 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 wah.
Too soon?
Very soon. As Oscar season enters its final stretch, many moviegoers and critics have been waiting on one event to signify the coming finish line. The announcement of the nominees. As of this Tuesday morning, we finally know who made it to the top of tops and are in the running for a prestigious Academy Award for their respective categories. So, to nobody's surprise, obviously La La Land is leading the pack with a whopping 14 Oscar noms. Now tied with the record-setting Titanic from 1997, as well as All About Eve, the 1950s film. That apparently is also up there with the 14 Oscar nominations.
Which is very exciting. If you want to hear more about La La Land, we did an episode about that last week. So just, scroll up in your feed and it's there.
It's the previous episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, Arrival and Moonlight came in second in terms of Oscar nominations, with both films tying at 8. And Lion and Manchester by the Sea each received 6. Gentlemen, I just have to ask. This is kind of the question that always seems to be asked. What are some of your surprise nominations that you weren't expecting to see nominated but ended up getting nominated? We'll go ahead and start with Chad.
Wow. I would say actually the thing that surprised me the most was Amy Adams not getting nominated for Arrival. I would have believed ABC when they announced that she was a nominee because, I mean, obviously the movie did receive several nominations and it kind of rises or falls on her performance specifically. So it's interesting, obviously, each category, each submission that a studio puts in is specifically for that category. They submit a segment of footage or, you know, what have you, to demonstrate the skill of the person mm-hmm. being nominated. So it's kind of a process. It's just interesting that they've got, you know, director, film, adapted screenplay, and no best actress nod. That was the big surprise for me, more so than who was on the docket, was that she was left off.
True. What about you, Mark? Who are some of the surprises that you saw on this list? Or surprises that you were expecting and didn't show up? Kind of like Chad's.
I mean, I was expecting Taraji P. Henson from Hidden Figures to be nominated because she did really well in Hidden Figures. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know how much of a video game comic book guy I am. And yeah. I was honestly really expecting some sort of nomination for Deadpool.
Yeah, we were actually talking about that on the way over here, and I was telling him there's quite a bit of people who are actually surprised at not seeing Deadpool on here. I could honestly probably see for an adapted screenplay. We had mentioned that probably would have gotten the more believability in terms of Oscar nominations. Other categories, though, where else do you think he could have fit? Where else do you think that film could have really impact?
Even the production categories, like where all genre flicks, you know, get nominated for, not even one nomination. Even Suicide Squad got a nomination.
I was going to say, what about the hair and makeup category?
Yeah,
come on.
That was
category.
Ridiculous. I was like,
his face was all jacked up for a while.
And Killer Croc looked like, you know, one of those Rena people that you get for Halloween, for parties and whatnot. I was like, it wasn't really all that great to say, oh, we should give them an Oscar nomination, unless DC and Warner Brothers really, you know, paid some people off for, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, they may have. You never know.
But, yeah, and since you said it, Suicide Squad getting nominated for anything, seeing as Batman versus Superman received a ton of Razzie nominations as well.
Loads
of Razzie nominations. It wasn't too far off. In fact, out of the two, I would have rather had seen Suicide Squad a little bit more, but they were kind of still around the same.
More where? In the Razzies or in the Oscars?
I would have seen the film.
Oh, seen it more often.
Yes.
Numerous times.
If I had a choice between those two films, I would have seen Suicide Squad.
You would have gone back to see it again.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
yeah, same here.
But to the effect to think that, oh, but it was an Oscar-worthy film, which is ultimately what it's saying. It's saying Suicide Squad is an Oscar-worthy film.
Could be an Oscar-worthy.
Could be an Oscar-worthy film.
You've still got four other contenders in that category, and they're guaranteed to not get one. I would be very surprised if they won an Oscar from that movie of any sort.
Yeah.
I'm a little worried. I'm just saying.
Well,
now, if they had Joker in the movie more often, who knows? Because his makeup was pretty extraordinary. I mean, it was pretty extreme.
Well, actually, Suicide Squad does have a really, really good chance because it's only going up against two other nominees. A Man Called Ove and Star Trek Beyond. And that's it.
Oh.
So
it's
got
a short
really
category,
good,
which
it's
usually
got a really
means
good chance.
Either nobody submitted or they didn't. When you submit for the category, you don't follow the rules, and so you get disqualified.
Yeah,
if you didn't, you know, check off all the boxes. That's interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, I just, that's gonna be really scary. It'd be just because then now
I'm already intimidated
because of the fact that the bar becomes set so low, and not that it was a bad thing, but the fact that, I mean, we take film and obviously everybody that's on this podcast, I can assuredly say that every single person that is on tonight's show is a valid film critic. We all go to film. We review films here on the podcast. I review films in writing or online. Mark does the same for Nerd Reactor. So we have our credibility. Can we honestly say that come at the end of this year, when DC is going to be starting to promote all their other films like Justice League and whatnot, that when we hear the name and the award-winning film Suicide
Squad, Oscar-winning Suicide Squad,
just that doesn't shake you? I mean, that, like, as a fan of film, I am concerned for cinema right now.
Well, but again, it's in the context of having only two other contenders.
And also, this isn't, you know, any of the prestigious awards. Like, you can't say award-winning, you know, the award-winning film for best makeup, like Suicide Squad. Like, you know, like, people who advertise movies won't use that as bait to get people to come see DC movies because, you know, it's not as prestigious.
Right,
you know what I'm saying?
It's the kind of category where you're like, what did they win the Oscar for? Best makeup? And then everybody's like, oh.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's not director or cinematography.
To quote a saying from a film that started out well and is now this just ridiculous franchise, it doesn't matter if you win by an inch or a mile, winning is winning. And as long as they have that Oscar on their shelf, they're going to continue to say, oh, by the way, yeah, we got an Oscar. Yeah, yeah, on our first year. Yeah. And that's how I'm...
First year?
Of making their...
First year?
You know what?
What?
You know what
They've
I mean.
They've been trying for a while, half of a decade.
To get a universe going?
Yeah.
I mean, Man of Steel came, what, like 20...
13?
Yeah, 2013.
I think it was 2013, yeah. So, you know, but... It's still maybe Star Trek Beyond will get it.
They had
lots of people in alien costumes and makeup in there.
I will be fervently praying for that. But I mean, another kind of surprise for myself and I know you, Chad, as well, that we were thinking the same thing. The lead actress category didn't have Amy Adams for Arrival, and I think out of everything that Amy Adams has done over the last few years, including her stint in Man of Steel and then, you know, BVS and even Nocturnal Animals. the fact remains is that she did a phenomenal job and a very believable job in Arrival, to the point to where she almost came off as a totally different actress rather than what we're used to.
And if she hadn't done such a good job, it would not have felt like such a good movie.
True.
Yeah.
It really did hinge on her performance.
So I'm super surprised that she didn't get it. In fact, I mean, I guess Meryl Streep must have did an outstanding job. I don't know. I didn't personally see the film.
I actually just saw that movie 2 nights ago because
Florence
I'm doing
Foster Jenkins.
Yeah, because I'm doing the Blu-ray review for it soon, and she did a good job, like, you know, as Meryl Streep does. But in terms of best actress, like, I don't know. This thing kind of feels like, okay, Eddie, I know you watch basketball. Chad, I don't know if you do, but you know how the MVP race for basketball always has LeBron James in it because he's the best ever. Well, not best ever, but best in the game right now. And I feel like this is what the Academy is doing with Meryl Streep, is that any movie that she's in, she's going to get, you know, more likely than not nominated because she's Meryl Streep and she's great.
Which is true and often works for another person that was a surprise for me to not be around as much, Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
Usually if Martin Scorsese puts out a film, it's got like half a dozen nominations at minimum, you know, and this time around Silence, not so much.
I mean, it got one nomination for cinematography.
Yeah.
Which well-deserved.
It very well deserved. The film is very beautiful, but not seeing, because obviously Andrew Garfield did a phenomenal job in Hacksaw Ridge, so they're gonna go for that one. He's had more time to do promotions, to campaign for that. But Viggo Mortensen, I didn't see Captain Fantastic, but it didn't really stand out as a film that I really wanted to see. And you know, a man who lives in the woods with a bunch of kids. Seems like Peter Pan gone wrong, you know, kind of deal.
Right.
I don't know. Did you see that
it's
one,
It's like there was an old woman who lived in a shoe who had so, but it, instead of an old woman, it's Captain Fantastic.
It's an old man who lives in a van.
Yeah. There you go.
There you go.
There's the rhyme.
There you go.
That's all you need.
Yeah. Did you see this one, Mark?
No, but I did see the trailer for it right before I saw Hunt for the Wilder People, and it really does look like a feel-good movie, because and I've heard from many, many, many other people that Viggo Mortensen is absolutely amazing in it. And these are people that I actually, you know, respect their opinion. So I kind of have to believe them on
that. As opposed to the two of us.
True.
Just kidding. But you guys haven't seen the movie yet, though.
That is true.
No, he got a lot of good word of mouth when it was doing, like, the, I think it did a film festival circuit, you know, earlier in the year.
I do have to, though, throw out a couple of really great great nominees. We got Ruth Negga. Ruth Negga's on the line for lead actress in Loving. Hell or High Water was a surprise for you, I believe, because we were talking about it in the kitchen, and you were like, what?
Yeah, I wanted to love the movie, and don't get me wrong, it was a very enjoyable movie. It was kind of one of those, it had classic Western themes, but in the form of a heist film, kind of. Very well written. Taylor Sheridan, who we've been a fan of since Sicario, wrote that screenplay as well. There was a lot to love within it. Having it nominated for one of the in the Best Picture category was a surprise to me. I thought that there were other stronger contenders in the field for that particular category. But the other categories, sure. Jeff Bridges in Supporting Actor, he got a nod for that. I totally support that. He was great in the film. The screenplay itself, I fully support that. It's just that one category surprised me. And I'll tell you something else that surprised me. You had mentioned Nocturnal Animals earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Shannon got a supporting actor nod for his role in that film, which he was really, really good in that. He was like the best.
He was one of the best parts
of the movie. But Aaron Taylor Johnson, who plays really the antagonist in the whole thing, he just won a Golden Globe a couple weeks ago for his role, but he didn't get a nod in the Oscars. So that was interesting to me to see.
Yeah. I'm really hoping that a lot of these films that really stood out this past year kind of get that recognition and they kind of get that attention that's necessary. But who knows? I mean, the Oscars are always a crapshoot when it comes time to, you know, Zero Hour. It's always one of those things where there could be a ton of nominees for a particular film or for a particular franchise or whatever, and they all totally get wiped out for another one that nobody was expecting.
Sure.
So, but you know, we'll of course keep our ears to the ground, and we plan to do full coverage as soon as it comes about, because obviously, you know us, we love our movies.
We like to talk.
We like everything. True. Yes.
Pretty much.
But that does bring us to our special presentation of the evening, and we are talking about a film that is deeply disturbing, a film that,
well,
because of the fact that there's hints of truth in it, it's a documentary of
it is not a documentary.
We are talking about tonight
it's
M. Night Shyamalan's
no it's not that either
wait what
what did you go say? Ahead
we're talking about M. Night Shyamalan's Split. Yes.
Is that all you got? So Split, you may have seen the trailers. You may have seen the movie, in which case, tell us if you agree with what we say in the next 30 minutes or so.
True.
Stars James McAvoy. He is a man who has grown up with dissociative identity disorder, which many people, you know, just multiple personality. But DID, I guess, is the clinical definition of that. And so each personality shows up in, you know, different at different times, has different speaking patterns, different abilities and capabilities, and so there's a certain amount of kind of real world experience in this field that's woven in somewhat into the subtext, at least the context of the story. But what happens is James McAvoy, his character, kidnaps three teenage girls in a mall parking lot and imprisons them in a lair as potential sacrifices for a new personality that is supposedly going to emerge, you know, in a matter of days from when they're kidnapped.
Yeah. It's, like I said, it's a really interesting film. We went to go see that this past weekend. Actually, Mark had a chance to see it well later in last year, around November.
Around November, around AFI Fest.
Yeah, yeah. Mark is currently located in L.A., so obviously he gets a lot of those lovely little invites and whatnot and doesn't tell us anything. But it's all good. It's all good. But the film is directed by M. Night Shyamalan. As Chad says, it does star James McAvoy, Anya Taylor-Joy, Haley Lou Richardson, Jessica Sula, and Betty Buckley. If you're familiar with any of the films that came out last year, Anya Taylor-Joy is the young girl who is in February's release of the movie The Witch, which she did an outstanding performance in that one. And so this is her returning performance, I guess, later on in the year. And she was just as good in this one. As Chad said, the film synopsis is, though Kevin James McAvoy has evidenced 23 personalities to his trusted psychiatrist, Dr. Fletcher, there remains one still submerged who is set to materialize and dominate all the others. Compelled to abduct three teenage girls led by the willful, observant Casey, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, Kevin reaches a war for survival among all those contained within him, as well as everyone around him, as the walls between his compartments shatter apart. It's very dramatic.
That's a. I was gonna say that's a very melodramatic way of describing what's happening.
When you,
I mean, it's like don't try to make it poetry. It was a fairly straightforward story.
Yeah. This is straight from their own website.
No, I know. I know. Well, I mean, M. Night Shyamalan by this point needs some kind of a pick me up.
The film first debuted at last September's Fantastic Fest in a surprise screening to delighted fans. It later debuted at as Mark said, the AFI Fest. Last November, and the film was eventually theatrically released on January 20th of this year in the U.S., the U.K., and Canada. So Mark's been sitting on this for a good amount of time. We just saw it this past Saturday in a theater filled with teenagers, which is the reason why.
And a surprisingly large amount of small children.
Yeah.
What?
Oh, yeah. Like there was 4, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds. Yeah.
It was ridiculous. I was like, this exactly. I turned to Chad. I'm like, this is why we don't buy tickets anymore. We go to press.
We go to press screenings.
We don't need this.
What are we doing?
What
here?
Are we doing with our life? And it was. I don't know. We had missed out on this one. We had seen probably something else. Whatever it may have been, we went and saw it this past weekend. And so, Mark, first impressions of the film.
First impression, oh my God, M. Night Shyamalan actually made a good movie. That is my first impression. Because I have not seen, what was the last movie that he did? The one with the grandparents.
The Visit. Or The Visitation.
The Visit.
Or The Visit, yeah.
The Visit. And I didn't see that because after seeing After Earth, I told myself, no more M. Night Shyamalan movies. None whatsoever. He made me mad because I actually paid 3D surcharge prices to go see Last Airbender, and I was pissed after that.
he's been disappointing audiences for years.
True.
Yeah.
And it's and like, then, oh, go ahead.
Oh, no. And then afterwards, I didn't even pay for After Earth.
Lucky
a friend
you.
Of mine, yeah, a friend
I
of mine
did.
Just got it off. Oh, dang.
I know.
Yeah, sadly, we got guilt tripped into going to see After Earth
by a dear friend.
By a dear friend, I mean, con is a more closer word, but still, I say guilt tripped into seeing After Earth. But sadly, you know, there have been just no signs of upward progression for M. Night Shyamalan ever since, no pun intended, ever since Signs. From Signs on, it has just been a downward spiral. You had the ridiculousness of The Village. The idea of the story was great. The execution was done poorly.
And that's the thing that often is the case, that that the premise of the story is compelling. The execution of the story falls way short of what you hope for.
Because, I mean, let's face it. The Village was beautiful. It was a very beautiful film. There's a lot of, like, so we just happened to see Cinefix's top 10 films that, you know, utilize color. And it had me thinking, it had me going back to Signs, and Signs use a very unique color palette for their entire film. A lot of dark, a lot of grays, a lot of more drawn out colors, you know, with the only things that stood out were the yellows and the reds. And it was very beautiful, which is something that M. Night Shyamalan is known for. And then it just, like,
Well, I mean, he had great success with The Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
And then you had your Signs and your Unbreakable and some of those immediate follow-up films that had a certain satisfaction factor, at least. And then you went into The Village and Lady in the Water and all of those that kind of just sort of, they hit at a mid-range.
Yeah.
And it's not that they're all terrible. Some of them are. After Earth is horrendous, I think.
God.
In my opinion, it was so bad. The Last Airbender was like, fell way short of its mark, and it should have been like a slam dunk with hardly any effort. So, you know, there have just been so many poor performances or outings, not performances. It's not on the actors necessarily, but just poorly done, not satisfying films. So it, as Mark was saying, it is nice to come out of this film and say, oh, that was actually a satisfying M. Night Shyamalan movie.
True.
Yep.
Because, like you said, you know, Lady in the Water, I don't know, The Village, The Happening, oh my gosh, that was...
Oh, God.
You know, I don't think I could ever get over the fact that he's apologizing to a plastic plant in that film.
Oh.
And then we went to go see After Earth, and I'm like, this isn't even the last nail in the coffin. This is the new layer of soil above 100-foot deep, you know, grave, you know, topped with concrete and everything else. This is just, there's not even a word for it.
But again, the story itself had so much.
I'm not weak. Yeah, weak.
So much promise. And that's the thing. It's when you make a promise to your audience and you don't follow through with it.
Mm.
You give them something that's so subpar, it actually makes them dislike you more than they otherwise would for just a subpar movie, because they were expecting, oh, this is when you're finally going to come back and do something good again. Well, thankfully, with Split, he really does. I mean, it doesn't fail to follow through on the promises that it's made, you know, in the movie trailers.
Yeah. And I think, because... there was a Q&A afterwards with M. Night, and he talked about how with Split, he just wanted to go back. Actually, even going back to The Visit, he wanted to go back to his roots in the way that he just wants to become a storyteller and not rely on anything else but, like, focus on the story, focus on the acting. And with Split, he recruited, like, a bunch of amazing creative people around him. The cinematographer for Split is the same guy that did the cinematography for It Follows. And I'm sure you guys have seen It Follows, and cinematography for that movie was great. And it was creepy. And there was something Ted, he talked about with the composer. But looking through this guy's IMDb, I forgot what it was, but he said that he heard this guy's score for some movie, and then he wanted him right away to do Split. And so, M. Night just went back to his roots, and I think it's paying well for him.
Yeah, and you talk about It Follows. It Follows, it's that 2014 film that just was so... unique in the way it told its story, and obviously it was like a large drawn out ad campaign for, you know, abstinence or whatever.
Right, yeah.
But the beauty was in its cinematography. The beauty was in how it staged certain scenes to where it looked like a work of art, you were watching like living art, and it was really, really beautiful. And I didn't actually know that the same cinematographer it follows is the one who did Split. It now makes a lot of sense. Like a lot of those long haul scenes that you see,
or the stairwell with the stairwell. Very artistic curvature to it.
And yeah. Or you know, even just the way the what would you call it? The little holding.
The lighting.
Well, the lighting.
Well, that's the thing. It's a very challenging setup for somebody who wants to be a distinguished cinematographer, because it's a pretty tightly contained environment.
Yeah.
Most of the film occurs in one of like three rooms in an abandoned like part of what looks like a warehouse at first. You learn later on that it actually is a different kind of place than you expected it to be. But it's essentially like an abandoned warehouse, and there are these small cinder block rooms with plywood, you know? So there's not a lot to work with. Aside from some of the, you know, lighting on the characters themselves.
True. But one thing that's really quick to note in the film, while they're filming those scenes in the cell, the room that's the locked room that they're in, the one that you see in the trailer and whatnot, the room itself, though, seems big at times, like in terms of them utilizing all the space that they have in that room. From the distance when they're filming from the door to the girls where they're sitting in the beds,
right,
the space between them seems substantial. And I think he did a really good usage of that space in the room itself, giving it a sort of grandeur, yet still...
Well, the very first shot when they're in this place of captivity, I thought the way that it was shot, they might be trying to trick you, and the girls were actually in different rooms already. They end up being in different rooms from each other because they keep trying to escape and don't succeed. But... the way that the very first establishing shot in that room, it had Anya's character on the left and the other two girls on the right, and there was like a stripe down the middle of the wall that looked like it could be if you were looking dead on through, like at a wall, but you didn't see its dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking, oh, well, maybe they're in actually different rooms and they don't want you to know that yet. Turned out they were in the same room, or there was some clever plan that was never followed through on with the movie. But I agree, it did look very large to begin with, and mm-hmm. then got kind of progressively smaller as the events of the film caused, you know, more urgency for the audience.
And let's just be honest with ourselves for a second. There's no way that M. Night Shyamalan is going to recapture what he had with The Sixth Sense. I mean, in all reality, there's no possibility of that happening, for the fact that The Sixth Sense was lightning in a bottle. It was a unique story for the time that it was in and the time that was going on around the world, around the United States, just the status of the world at the time. When that movie came about, it was such a you know, monkey wrench into the norm and really blew people away. So we're not going to ever see... You know, sorry to all those people who are holding their breath waiting for that, you know, one horror film to come from M. Night Shyamalan that's like, oh, this reminded me of The Sixth Sense. It was such, you know, it's the true successor to, you know, The Sixth Sense and whatever. He's not going to get back to that kind of storytelling. He's not going to get back to that type of, you know, bombastic filmmaking, unfortunately.
Well, I don't know that he needs to. I mean, some of his other, like, I also really appreciate Unbreakable.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't come to the level of Sixth Sense, but it has an appeal of its own.
Yeah.
And I definitely thought in even midway through Split, I was thinking, okay, like Unbreakable, it has certain things that I don't like that I would prefer were done better, aka the psychologist or the psychiatrist herself. She was like the lamest character ever. However, the overall feeling of the film, I was thinking, absolutely reminded me of Unbreakable, and the satisfaction that I had after, you know, reaching the end of that film.
Yeah, I was gonna get to that point in terms of it does share a similar likeness to the formula, not so much the story, but the formula of how they did Unbreakable, where it was interesting. You had said something right after we left the film, Chad, and you had said that this film is grounded in reality. It has moments where it's grounded in reality, which is what made Unbreakable so unique.
Sure.
And which, obviously, Sixth Sense, there's not really much reality set in that. But this film, I think that's M. Night Shyamalan's kind of form of all forms. I think if he stays within that mindset, not so much, because I get it. The guy wants to be creepy at times. That's cool. I mean, he did The Visit. He did he produced that film Devil I keep telling you about.
Right, the elevator one.
He tries to do other things, you know, whatever. But his true form of forms has got to be, you know, grounded in some type of reality. It has to have one hand holding on to, you know, the world itself, and the other hand holding on to, you know, his dreams and hopes in terms
something
of what he wants
really
to tell.
Creepy.
Yeah. And I think that works for him. But the fact is that he keeps bouncing from place to place. I mean, Mark, I know you're a big anime fan. You know, how disappointed were you when you saw The Last Airbender?
Highly, because you can't mess that up. It's so easy to adapt Last Airbender and make it a feature film, but he just achieved the impossible and messed it up.
He found a way.
He found a way.
Yeah.
Life found a way. So
thank you, Jeff Goldblum.
I try.
Dr. Ian Malcolm, everybody.
But I say that to say, when we first heard, we were like, okay, M. Night Shyamalan is going to adapt The Last Airbender. At the time, The Last Airbender was still a pretty big deal on Nickelodeon, on anime, you know, forums and whatnot, for the people who were watching it, however they were watching it, it was still a big deal at the time. So everybody got excited, like, oh, cool, we're going to see Aang, and we're going to see him really, you know, just everything that we loved about The Last Airbender, you know, series, we're going to see it come to fruition, and we're going to see it manifest in reality on the big screen.
And what sure, there got, was a lot of anticipation
there
for
was
that movie.
A
lot.
A ton of an anticipation. And what we got was, like, this ridiculous, dare I say, incorrect casting, first off, and then you had this story that just borderline ridiculous in terms of the overall story, and the film was just, it was bad.
Well, the problem with Last Airbender is that he took, if I remember correctly, the first season and just basically put it all in one movie.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a lot of episodes, and that is a lot of time to crunch into an hour and a half, 2 hour film. And that was the biggest problem, was that everything just felt rushed, and like you said, the bad casting choices. It was just, man, I had such high hopes for that, just because after doing a lot of horror movies, this was touted as his first foray into, you know, non-horror film, and yeah. I thought, okay, maybe this is gonna be the one movie that brings him out of his funk, is something that's not horror related. And when I watched it, I was like, wow, no, you are still in your funk, and you probably dug yourself deeper in that hole.
True. You know, it was bad. And then for that, because that was right after The Happening, and then after that, obviously we had that wonderful, you know, film After Earth with Will Smith and his son doing all those wonderful accents and whatnot, and we passed on, you know, M. Night Shyamalan for dead, because
yeah,
we just
basically
didn't,
yeah,
we just, nobody really wanted to see anything else he did. So coming back to Split, having that type of formula that's grounded in reality and still pushing a story, a plot line that people can get engaged in and still have a fear of, like, oh, wait, but there's reality still involved in this. There's still some sense of truthfulness to storytelling. That is creepy. That is something that will really grab audiences, and that, I think, is where he excels.
Yeah, I mean, the big hook from that reality angle for this film is, you know, look, we know that there are people in the world who exhibit different personality, who have this particular dissociative identity disorder.
Yeah.
And you know, they it will be completely different personality settings, different voices, different mannerisms. Sometimes you'll have one personality can write with the right hand, the next personality writes with the left hand, both with, you know, equal skill and precision.
Yeah.
And so you know that there's some grounding in the story there. the core, I guess the niche philosophy or theory that that kind of fringe science element that's here in this story is the suggestion that along with the different personalities come some sort of chemical, physical changes in that same person's body from one personality to the next.
Yeah.
And so they're exploring, you know, because it's one thing to say, well, one personality has OCD, which in this movie there is one that has OCD, and the next one doesn't, or one of them is, you know, old and the other one is a child, because there's a very engaging personality, Hedwig, who is 9 years old and talks like a 9 year old, thinks like a 9 year old, behaves like a 9 year old, and the whole thing. But so you watch different mannerisms, but then beyond mannerism, is there something physically different, you know, chemically different from one to the next? And that's really, you know, what the story is progressing toward, you know, near into the climax.
And it's interesting that you mentioned the personalities, because the person who exudes all these in the film is James McAvoy. And I mean, honestly, he carried that film. Easily.
Yeah.
This was his film to just, I don't know if this was an exercise in every single acting class that he's ever taken, but the man did an absolute just outstanding job in creating not just one, but all 23 of these personalities. You know,
well, I mean, you see like eight of them,
eight or nine of them, you know, through video or through whatever. But the fact is that he's still one of the most interesting things for me when I was watching it was the times when he is jumping in and out of each personality when he's looking in the mirror or when he's talking to somebody. You know,
I was just about to say that.
That was so just crazy seeing how at one point he was the little boy and then instantaneously he would jump to the person with OCD, and then he would jump to the woman, and then he would jump back to the little boy. And it was like, that's a pretty talented type of mindset to have, to be able to jump all those on that type of scale of jumping back and forth into each personality.
And the thing is, he did that seamlessly too.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely seamless. And that particular scene that you're talking about is just amazing to watch, and shows you how good of an actor James McAvoy is. Like, I thought he was good before, like, really good before, but this puts him up on another level for me.
What I loved about it, too, is that one of the things, Eddie, I said to you when we walked out of the theater was, I wasn't expecting as much humor as there is. I think that in addition to the creepiness and the strangeness of the story, as he's switching between personalities, and especially I think the bulk of it is with Hedwig, the 9 year old, there's a surprising amount of humor in the story as well. I mean, here you have a story of like young women who have been kidnapped and imprisoned and are going to be sacrificed to this somewhat demonic emergent personality that has yet to appear. They all call it the Beast, and that none of them have ever seen it yet, but they know that it's coming, and it's going to inhabit his body. I mean, there's this very off-putting aura about the overall like warning that's happening through the personalities. However, you have moments of brevity or of levity. Through the humor and through the way that the personalities are displayed. I would say, too, on the performance level, this isn't the kind of performance that's going to get James McAvoy an Oscar.
No.
It's not even necessarily... I don't think that you look at it and you say, man, that must have been so difficult. I think, really, you look at it and you say, man, that must have been so much fun as a performer. Like, I think I enjoyed seeing him essentially use the screen as a giant sandbox, like a giant playground, and just hop over here, hop over there. Let me show you how versatile I can be.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Not in like a melodramatic way.
No. And I think him being able to be that kind of playful while still exuding that much talent, it just shows how much of a, you know, versatile actor of the type of actor he is. It really plays well into the mindset of, you know, if he could do this, I mean, there's pretty much no limits to this guy in any role that he ever wanted to play. You know, we're used to seeing him in a wheelchair and bald, you know, for most of our film, you know, history.
Or as part goat.
Or part goat in Chronicles of Narnia. But whatever it may be, this film is pretty much like his resume. I mean, he could just, if he were to ever get questioned by any studio, oh, by the way, do you think you could do an OCD guy from Boston? Oh, haven't you seen Split? Oh, yeah. What about a woman? Can you play a woman? Split?
Right.
So there's just, for me, there's nothing to doubt his ability, like pretty much from this film on forward.
Which is really great for him because he was not actually the original actor cast in the film.
What?
He was the backup.
Really?
Yeah, Joaquin Phoenix was actually the original. Kevin / Patricia / Hedwig / Dennis / the Beast / whatever.
What?
But he had a schedule conflict and James McAvoy took it on.
No offense to Joaquin Phoenix, but thank God.
Yeah.
It would have felt like a much different movie if it was Joaquin Phoenix in the role. It would. Yeah. I think it would not have had as much fun feeling to it. Maybe that's just because he tends to do dramatic movies.
Yeah,
but.
Because he was supposed to be part of the comedic relief in the same way that James McAvoy's some of the personalities were, or one of his personalities were. That's what Joaquin Phoenix's role was in Signs. And it didn't come that way. It didn't, you know, surface that way. It didn't make it evident that way. He just came off as a normal guy just doing stuff. And, oh, by the way, you know, I'm falling out of bed because I hear a scream. But you're supposed to laugh as the audience. You know, it just doesn't pass off that well for Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
And then, so we come to the end of the film. And that's one of the things I know we want to talk about the most because of the fact that it kind of draws the biggest oohs and ahs from us here. And and obviously, James McAvoy is planning to sacrifice, like Chad said, these three teenage girls to something called the Beast, which is something that they believe in or whatever. And he ends up being the Beast, a 24th personality that he ends up, you know, becoming at the end of the film. And he ends up killing two of the girls and finds the last one, which is Anya Taylor-Joy's character, I guess not really worth eating or something.
Well, the whole thing was that they had to, they essentially it's a virginal sacrifice, right?
Mm.
So
yeah.
Essentially they have to never have faced true hardship in their lives, and thus they're not worth being alive anymore, and they need to be sacrificed so that the Beast can emerge and claim dominance over the other 23 personalities, mm-hmm. and start to change the world beyond that. And then over the course of the conflict, and you've seen a lot of foreshadowing of things that have happened in Casey's past, Anya Taylor-Joy's character, that leads you to understand that she's had hardship.
Yeah.
That she doesn't, she's not the same as these other two girls. Well, eventually, the Beast ends up recognizing this in her as well and leaving her alone.
Yeah.
Honestly.
So the Beast,
I mean, they fight for a little while, but then he backs off.
He sees that she's gone through some stuff and he tells, you know, rejoice. He's really weird. And so he backs away. He disappears. She's found by the morning crew, which you find out the underground, facility,
the
is
lair
actually,
of the Beast.
The lair of the Beast is in the maintenance area of a zoo, and so they find Casey. The police rescue her. They come and get her. Somebody from the zoo finds her. The police come. The, you know, and whatnot. And so that all resolves. Obviously, James McAvoy is off somewhere looking at his body, and the three personalities looking at his body.
He's off somewhere looking at his body,
and that's kind of, that was the scene that me and Mark were talking about, the scene where those three personalities are seamlessly bouncing in and out of what they call the light.
It's similar to the Smeagol and Gollum interaction in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. And so that all resolves. That the film, you know, cuts to black, and then we see a later clip where there is a diner where everybody's watching the TV and they're talking about the events that had occurred with James McAvoy's character. And they're talking about how he's on the loose, how he killed these two girls, and that he's constantly whatever, he's still on the loose. And they give him a name. They call him the Horde. And as soon as they do that, they pan to these two ladies who are sitting at the counter at the diner, and they're like, oh man, it's just like that one guy, that one comic book guy who from 15 years ago, the guy in the wheelchair, what was his name? And we get the big twist at the very end of that film as Bruce Willis leans forward and says, Mr. Glass. And they're like, what? And then, Mr. Glass. And you're focused on Bruce Willis, and it takes a second to realize, holy crap, this is Unbreakable. They're in the same universe.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's incredible because of the fact that I was telling Chad, one of the great things about that scene, one of the things I love the most, which it still follows the formula that he uses. Normally, whenever you have these moments where you have this long-awaited hero make his presence known, they did it in BVS. They do it in all the other types of action films. Once they begin to notate that the hero is present, they immediately cut, leaving you with like, oh, we could have seen his face. They linger on Bruce Willis's face after he says the name the second time. And you're looking at him.
Yeah, they kind of get up and leave, ladies, and he's still there.
and they let the camera stays on his face, allowing the viewer to see everything that's going to happen, everything that is setting in, him realizing that there's something else out there. And just
he needs to get to work.
That he needs to get to work. But the fact remains is that the few seconds that they leave on him, it allows that sense of reality to soak in into the character and allows the viewer to see him as human, even though he's not human, but you see the human side to him. And I just thought that was so genius.
Well, I mean, that's a big part of his character, David Dunn in Unbreakable,
that's
Bruce Willis' character.
His name, David Dunn.
Is that he's not, okay, he's unbreakable, but he's not pursuing that comic book lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Samuel L. Jackson's character continues to force it upon him, really. And you know, that groundedness is really a lot of the core of that film, is the David Dunn character really doesn't want to have anything to do with all the supernatural hokey whatever, mm-hmm. even though it's true of him, you know,
mm-hmm.
he wants to have a normal life, you know, and that's kind of, it's a great counterpoint to this story. It's a great ending point to this story, mm-hmm. where it kind of brings it all the way back down to, oh, and here we go again. This guy is just trying to live a normal life, but quite frankly, by the end of the movie, the beast is on the loose. He's not captured. So yeah, there may be opportunity for some form of a follow-up.
Mark, when you were at AFI, what was the reaction of everybody when they saw that?
Oh, pure joy. Like, everyone was cheering. Me and Arvin, who is a buddy of mine who also does a lot of the cinematography for John's videos for Nerd Reactor, he and I actually knew about the twist beforehand.
Oh, boy.
Because, and which is actually great, because now that you guys have seen it, if you go back and watch it again, you see some sort of signs that they're talking about a superhero universe within that, especially when the psychiatrist lady is talking with having like a TED talk or whatnot with the other people and talking about how having these split personalities is kind of like having a superpower. And when I heard that and knew about the twist, I was like, okay, so they're trying to, you know, connect the dots and leave like little breadcrumbs for people to find when they watch it again.
Mm-hmm.
But the entire time I was watching, I was like, okay, this is where Bruce Willis is going to come in. No, okay, this is where Bruce Willis is going to come in. And when the ending came about, I have to admit, I was kind of disappointed, because I thought, oh man, here's some like another like lackluster ending to an M. Night Shyamalan movie, until we finally got up to the post-credit stinger, and then that's when it's like, oh my god, here it is. Like, oh my god, this is, even though I knew what that it was part of the Unbreakable universe, I was like, man, this is actually cooler than I thought it was going to be, like, originally. And the whole thing, even though I knew what was going to happen, still surprised me, because, you know, it didn't really show up during the movie, but it makes me excited for another Unbreakable movie. I want to see Bruce Willis go up against James McAvoy.
The Beast.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, because some of the theoretical content from a psychological point of view of the whole physiological changes spurred by this shift from one personality to the other, that actually in this film is shown to be true. Mm-hmm. He does get really thick skin. He climbs on walls. He can take shotgun blasts to, like, point blank range, shotgun blasts to his
context to why
torso,
he was looking at his body,
so. Which is why he's later looking at his body, you know, without being killed. I mean, like, he does, similar to, you know, David Dunn in Unbreakable, like, there is a physiological difference, to him. And it's a great thing for M. Night Shyamalan that this film dominated the box office over the weekend, made back all of its money and more, and is still going to go, because he now is saying that Unbreakable 2 is what he wants to do next.
I'm not going to lie. I'm going to be real with you guys. I don't want to see a sequel. I don't want to see a sequel to this film or Unbreakable. I want this to stay here. I want this to be the end of it, and I want him to move on to something else, for the fact that I just, the way it ended, the way the film goes, obviously there's much anticipation for what could be, but I think leaving it there could probably be one of the best things he could do to this franchise, and use this as a launching pad for other things. Use the attention for it. Use the momentum to build on to other properties that he wants to work
Which
on.
Which is exactly why that's not what's going to happen.
Well,
it would be a great ending.
He actually is doing another movie. I'm looking at his IMDb page right now, and he's doing something called Labor of Love next, which is a widower embarks on a cross-country trip on foot to prove his love for his late wife.
Hmm.
That's his next movie.
Well, thankfully it's
right,
not.
Right, that one I think is in, what, pre-production or production. I think it was just because Split had a good weekend, they started asking him, and he said, yeah, I'd love for Unbreakable 2 to be my next project. But I'm sure he's already started on, what is it, Labor of Love? So,
yeah, Labor of Love.
Yeah. Of course, he wouldn't have said that if Split didn't have a great weekend.
No, probably not.
You got to hedge your bets a little bit.
I was going to say, you had me worried there for a second. So with all that said, where are we standing with this film? Does it pass or does it fail? And how many monocles do we have? Mark, in case you're not aware, the way we rate things on this film, on this show, not this film, we rate it 1 through 5, and we rate it by monocles, much like Nerd Reactor does Adams. So, okay. Chad, does it pass or fail for you, and how many monocles do you give it?
You know, it does pass. Again, it surprised me. I actually was not expecting it to be good, given the track record, the recent track record of Mr. Shyamalan. I would say in terms of monocles, I'd give it a solid 3. It's somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
I really didn't like the psychiatrist character. She was mostly superfluous. And I wasn't always sold on Anya Taylor-Joy either. She was kind of boring to me in a lot of the scenes. But James McAvoy was terrific, so 3.
Mark, how about yourself?
I would give it a pass as well, and probably give it 3.5 monocles. I kind of at first leaned towards 4 after seeing the movie, but thinking about it and stewing on it, 3.5, because James McAvoy just completely sold that movie to me. The Unbreakable twist is amazing, and you know, there were certain things that needed to be helped, but overall I still really enjoyed the heck out of it.
Same here. I'm actually going to pass the film and give it 3.5 because of the fact that I liked the fact that it was actually good, you know, for one thing. You know, we're like, all right, we can actually like him now. You know, he's got good stuff.
It's the benefit of the adjusted bar being set lower.
And the fact that James McAvoy did such an incredible job in this film. So I got to give it a 3.5. But yeah. That wraps up another incredible episode of The Filmlosophers. Again, if you have any comments on the show or you want us to talk about this film again, or if you have any opinions yourself about the film, you know, who knows? Maybe you're like, you know what? You guys need to see it again. You got to catch everything you missed. Drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Mark, it was great having you on, man. Where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at PacmanNR7, Pac-Man like the video game NR7, which is also happens to be my Instagram account as well.
All right. Beautiful. Sounds good. And a quick reminder before we go, make sure you cast your vote, monkeysfightingrobots.com. Let them know that we
amateur
are your
podcast.
Exactly. We are your amateur podcast of 2016.
That's right.
So from all of us here at The Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.